Eric, one of the things I always thought was interesting about your studies and your work is your interest in play, and you actually did a course on nothing. So perhaps you could speak a little more about this side of your work, your interest in play and man the player as opposed to man the worker and this sort of thing.
Well, I think that historically the whole spirit of seriousness has become a kind of a set of constraints that are kind of inimical to the depth of life, more or less, is how I see it. And that the other side of the scale, fancy way of talking about that, would be the ludic side of life. Ludic just means playful. It's about high time for us to emphasize that a little bit more, I think.
Are you referring to the book Homo Ludens?
I was in my past. Yes, I was conceiving of things more or less that. Who's that Dutch guy that wrote that?
Yeah, I haven't got his name right now.
More or less in that sort of way. Now, the idea of Homo Ludens is that, part of what Homo sapiens is trying to do right now is to struggle past its outer perimeter, its self-definition, toward ultimately a new form or new order of being. And the Dutch guy, whose name I can't remember, postulated that new order
Huizinga.
Of being is not going to be defined by sapiens in Latin, which means something like knowing, like man the knower, or man the wise is another translation, and would be defined more in terms of play or this ludic dimension of life. Ludens in Latin means playing, right? So,
The guy's name is Huizinga.
Oh, Huizinga. Well, my Dutch is a little bit rusty, I got to admit. So.
Yeah, no, I don't know how to say it, but Huizinga, I just looked it up.
All right, well, good. You're pretty quick on the draw. But yeah, that idea that, we're struggling toward a new order of being that's going to be centered more in terms of play. To me, that's part of what all of this technology and actually the preceding discussion is aiming toward, that it requires...
Yeah, do you know that McLuhan made a big deal out of play? He was the philosopher of play.
I didn't know that. So did Nietzsche.
Oh, yeah, he built on Homo Ludens. Huizinga's book, and then he uses it all over the play. His definition of tactility was the play between the axle and the wheel, and he applied that to everything.
Yeah. Well, have
yeah,
you
so
read that
interplay
book by
of play.
James Carse, Finite and Infinite Games?
No, I don't know that.
Oh, well, this is a book on game theory, and basically he postulates that there are two kinds of games. Games the way you normally think about it, in other words, games based upon the idea of winning and losing, he calls finite games. These are games played according to strict sets of rules. And the other type of game he calls infinite games. And the point of playing an infinite game is not to win or lose, but to have a good time, in essence. And it's not based around winning or losing. Moreover, infinite games, the play is, to some extent, with the rules and not merely according to the rules. And
this falls nicely with our talk with the hip-hop comedian, because we got into clowns and the role of games and how games reflect the medium of the day.
Yeah.
And what you're calling non-finite play is what I mean by phatic, phatic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's
phatic
a new
communication
word for me.
Is. Yeah, it's.
It sounds like a good coinage, though, phatic. I kind of like that.
Yeah, this is what's interesting. In 92, Russell Simmons started a store, and he called it Fat Farm, P-H-A-T. And I put a book out that same year called Phatic Communication with Bob Dobbs. And you get it from Roman Jakobson and Malinowski came up with the word phatic. And he had studied Trobriand Islanders, Pacific preliterate tribes. And he found that words didn't hold their society together, but objects and certain gestures were what cohered. And that's what that really inspired James Joyce and Marcel Duchamp. And then McLuhan built on it. And the importance of phatic communication is the way you're talking about, because games as finite, they reflect the industrial environment. Like baseball, what do the fans do? They add up the statistics and all that. Like they're all chartered accountants. for
and
that
well,
industrial
that's an
game
metaphor, because you know a lot of it I think is economically based.
Yes.
That we can
what you mean by economically would be what I call technoculture. So that when the instant replay came in, that made football more popular because the instant replay was more appropriate for such a fast-moving game. And just look at the way football is. One group has got some secret signals, and they're going to go out and fool the others with the thing. That's the normal industrial espionage in a corporate society.
Mm-hmm.
It's mimed right there in the way football is run.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's it's been that way for a long time. Part of my interest in the ludic dimension, by the way, has also to do with the whole business of percept, you know, perceiving and conceiving that we talked about in the first segment.
Right. Let me just say this. So that the using how games reflect the industrial cultures and its different media styles, that's within finite games. We've moved more into a talking culture and image culture, and that moves to the non-finite gaming. So tell me more about that. How that fits into what you're saying?
Well, one of the attributes of infinite games, according to Kurse, is that they're not mediated by the whole spirit of seriousness. They're about pleasure and gaining pleasure and that sort of thing. I think that it's about high time to begin to redefine what we think understanding is and thinking is in terms of more like an infinite game. Like, what's the point of knowing things? That was a strange question.
See, that's a literate thing. Knowing and categorizing is not important when you have to interact and come up with new content all the time.
Mm-hmm. But
you don't need to know. You invent new stuff.
Yeah.
You invent new words. You don't even write words. You go, you know, WTF, LOL,
yeah,
OMG. It's the demand of call and response moves it into the infinite level of game. It's just pure sensory pleasure to interact. So that's what talk shows became. And that includes the playfulness of running wars in the backyards of the world, being a soldier of fortune. That's a form of play now.
I don't know. You know, I'm not, you know, Baudrillard wrote a piece on that about the Gulf War. I'm not
yes.
sure I'd go quite that far. Because
wait a minute. We got to go that quite far. We got to go quite far, Eric. We're going in the 21st century.
Well,
we go that quite far with Bob. That's what I'm saying.
Well, the thing is that the way I see the world changing is more or less, for the most part, people need to be seduced one line at a time. You know. So if you're
that's a literate point
there. Having
society
go far, the world go far. I think it happens more by an ongoing seduction than it does by sort of immediately demanding that the world go far, the people go far, or something like that.
Okay, when you say one line at a time, you have to admit there's your literate bias. What do you really mean by that? Because you don't mean literacy.
No, I don't mean literacy. In fact, I mean moving beyond literacy, which I think is what we're doing. But the problem
well, we
is
have, yes.
that you have to use words, oddly, to get beyond literacy. You know, it's kind of
and
like...
And words go hand in hand for most of us with literacy. Our actual concept of words
exactly.
are in the realm of finite games. The
right.
infinite
so
games is body language and the iconographic.
The trick is to use words to precipitate a moment of discontinuity, I think, in people.
Yes.
Experience and how they construe the world and themselves and so on. This is, I think, this might be part of what makes Joyce so interesting, that he precipitated
yes.
a kind of moment of discontinuity in the ongoing meta-narrative of one narrative following the other to ultimately make sense of our lives. You know, so which is a paradoxical use of language, really. It's a kind of use of language that defeats the use of language. You
it's
know,
a playful use of language.
Right. I think it is playful. And there are moments, I think, you know, like Kierkegaard, for instance, has one moment where he says, well, if you get the point, you've reached the moment of existential decision, you need to throw this book down and discontinue reading it right now because now you have the point. Like a strange moment in literature to be commanded to throw the book down and stop reading it.
That's what Joyce realized. He
that's what we're all sort of struggling with is,
yes.
Well, how do we get beyond the confines of the world as we know it? Well, you need to work with the confines of the world as we know it in order to get beyond those confines.
Right, and more, that sounds like Baudrillard's looking for a standard that people bounce off of, the real, that's pretty hard to find today, what the standard is. In fact, that's caused the collapse of banking, international banking. Nobody can agree on what the standard reference to jump off from is.
Well, all the... The center cannot hold, you know, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, you know, and
The beast loses towards Jerusalem.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. and that might be, it might be the second coming in some sense. But, you know, what I've seen in glancing through the economic record of the last few centuries is a continual untying of what seem to be static mooring points that I think parallels in many ways the untying in terms of meaning and in terms of, believing in empirical inquiry into the objective world and all of that kind of stuff that parallels movements in art, like into abstract expressionism and stuff like that, Dadaism, and so on. And
okay, so how do you move humanistic psychology? Can it even be relevant in the 21st century? So how would you do that?
Well, once again, it's a matter of using the traditional language of humanistic psychology in a way that subverts its traditional moorings and begins to invite it to expand into these new and, I think, exciting provinces like consciousness shifting beyond narratives, beyond necessarily even sort of word use or at least conventional word use. It's a matter of a seduction, but that's the way, in my view, the world changes in general, not only how humanistic psychology might change, but how the world in general might change. You know, how can we begin to use language in a double-edged sense that begins to subvert the very use of language? That, to me, is an interesting project.
I would say that is...
It's a little like Kierkegaard's Throw Down This Book. It's a sentence that gets the reader to stop reading.
Right. That's why Joyce said... He told me through the Evergreens that he made a book that would not be finishable, one you'd read and put on the shelf. So he understood how to keep the book going by make it so rich and dense with suggestion and have the last sentence not end the book. That's a beginning of pointing out the endless 24/7 communication that goes on in the Android meme today.
Yeah,
the very discontinuity where you might want to do with language is happening as an environment.
Yes, and the only question is whether we're going to sort of own our participation in it. We're subject to it whether we like it or not. It's going to be happening whether we like it or not. But is it going to be, you know what, rough beast, it's our come round at last, is slouching toward Bethlehem to be born? Is it going to be like that? Is it going to be more like an infinite game?
Well, I see those themes as already happening and replayed. Like, for the world, it was pretty shocking, the Six-Day War in June 67. Then the oil shock of 73. And then SDI. Just think of all these hyped-up icons of news over the last 40 years and how they've come and gone. And the real apocalypse or Armageddon is the fact there's no finish line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bob, let me jump in if I may. Now, Eric, I just want to let you know I've been preaching humanistic psychology to Bob for a long time, trying to get him to read a little Rogers. So maybe we can team up on him and get him to read some Rogers. Now,
I've read some.
I succeeded.
Well, the thing is, like, the whole project of trying to get someone to read something is almost inimical to the humanistic psychological project.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, we're just going to have to gang up on you, Youngblood, whoever the hell you are.
Rumpelstiltskin, why are
Youngblood,
you
sorry.
Flipping the tables, Eric? Why you do that?
Huh? Well, I think that that's actually part and parcel of what humanistic psychology is about, to be honest. Like, I think
that's right.
Why?
To get a book is conceptual.
Humanistic psychology is all about process,
fair enough.
Right? If you read that On Becoming a Person, There's about five instances of the word process on every page. And I think what he means by process is, you know, the continual sort of unfolding of the dynamisms of life within us and relative to the world we inhabit and in the world as it bears upon our lives. So for me, it's actually, I'm not turning against you, young blood, but more or less sort of pointing out another side of the project, maybe.
Yeah, get that message.
In other words, humanistic psychology, insofar as it emphasizes process, in other words, the unfolding of the dynamism of our psychic lives, has implications for the project of humanistic psychology. The point of humanistic psychology is for it to overcome humanistic psychology.
And in broad terms, that's to come over the tendency to put it back in a book. Because the real fact is people and cultures trying to deal with this incredibly phatic and tactile Android meme, satirical environment that's going at people 24/7.
Yeah, well,
that's process with a capital P cubed.
The other thing about humanistic psychology is it's holistic. That's one of the first, it's almost axiomatic to humanistic psychology. And part of what that implies is that it moves with respect to changes in the world as that we inhabit, and it participates in those processes too. And
what's the word? Dualistic or holistic?
Holistic.
Holistic, okay.
Yeah, in other words, in terms of entireties that ultimately embrace the universe. Right?
Yeah.
Lives are relative to the happening of the universe, the happening of the universe is relative to our lives, and so on down the line. So kind of the idea is that, well, if you have a mode of psychology that emphasizes process so much and is holistic, well, what are the implications then for that project itself? Well, that project itself has to be subject to those same forces. After all, we're the ones who are inventing and constituting the project in the first place. So if we're subject to process, well, so too must our framework of understanding, in this case humanistic psychology, be subject to the same thing. So then the point of humanistic psychology, I think, or the implication of it, is how to accelerate those processes of a change so that they ultimately carry us, and along with it, our ways of understanding, and along with them, humanistic psychology itself, beyond itself. So
right, and then that makes it hard to certify who can be a humanist psychologist if the rules are changing that much.
Right.
That fact.
It's an ongoing process of redefinition, rather than sort of just reading the definition out of the Wikipedia and seeing to whom it applies and to whom it does not.
Right.
So Youngblood.
Hi.
Youngblood.
Yes, Youngblood here.
So what do you think of that? Do you think I'm still sort of a traitor to the cause? Or?
No, sounds good. I'll buy on to that.
All right.
Eric,
I didn't
think
were
we
you
got,
working
I
on something
Bob.
Else?
It
sounded
it
like
nice
I distracted
you. Switched
you
it like you were against me, but then we got Bob. I like it. Good technique.
No,
Bob,
yeah, well, I don't think I'm against you, Youngblood. I really don't.
No,
I don't care.
Yeah, Youngblood. When you told me to read Rogers last year in Five Bodied and 2 years ago, I had covered that in wrapped it up. See, McLuhan writes about Rogers and all that humanistic psychology and makes a good critique of it. And then Baudrillard moves it. I'm interested right now, what does Lacan, L-A-C-A-N, get used
Lacan.
By humanistic psychology? Lacan, yeah.
Yeah.
Does he get used by humanistic psychology?
No, not very often. In fact, very usually the Lacanians or Lacanians, usually they like to call themselves Lacanians, usually like to pretend that they're on the opposite side of the river from the humanistic psychologists and vice versa. But to me, that sort of tension is very artificial. Of course, you know, Lacan is coming out of the Freudian tradition, and more specifically, the structuralist or post-structuralist reading of Freud, that particular tradition, which takes all of the central kind of concepts and vocabulary and axioms of humanistic psychology and more or less poo-poos them and says, well, they're just sort of constructions according to certain, you know, certain kind of symbol play, basically. And they aren't as central or as important as these humanistic psychologists make them sound. On the other hand, the humanistic psychologists turn around and accuse the Lacanians of doing a kind of psychic reduction, either a reduction of life to the interplay of symbols or a reduction of life to the workings of the unconscious somehow, which, by the way, Lacanians conceive in terms of an interplay of symbols. And so they're usually kind of, they have a kind of an uneasy, inimical relation, basically. And
right.
But, you know, I was into Lacan for a while, you know, in graduate school and read a bunch of his books. And but I'm a kind of person, like, I don't, you know, I'm not, I guess I'm not a good Aristotelian. I'm sorry. I apologize. But, you know, I've never had problems sort of holding on to what seemed to other people to be incommensurable ideas at the same time or contradictory ideas. To me, contradiction is just sort of a fertile fields for some kind of new insight or new sensation or new bit of play, new bit of ludic experience, perhaps.
Yes.
So,
You're in the Dobbs camp. You're in the Dobbs camp.
More or less, I would say so, insofar as I know about it. I've only read one book by the Subgenius Foundation.
Well, before we get into Subgenius, you know, Eric, I want to let you know, I consider myself a Lacanian, and I don't see how they're mutually exclusive. You know, Maslow himself said first he was a Freudian, then he was a behaviorist, then he was a humanistic psychologist. So I don't get the people who think that, oh, okay, Lacan somehow cancels out humanistic psychology. I don't get it.
I don't get it either. Well, you know what they say? It's like the primacy of subjectivity conceived more or less in terms of an egoic position. That's what they really object to, right? That's what they don't like. But
That's what the Lacanians object to.
Huh?
Is that what the Lacanians object to?
Yeah, that would be the sort of Lacanian objection to humanistic psychology, is
right.
that this whole business of emphasizing the primacy of subjectivity, the primacy of experience, all that is a nasty bit of ego play that's ultimately about symptoms that you could do well to get over. Like, that's their bitch, basically, you know?
Yeah, you know how McLuhan would comment and satirize that? He'd say it's movie versus television. The humanists are movie. The Lacanians are television.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting because Lacan actually wrote a book called Television.
Television, as they say in French. It was also filmed, like it was a film presentation as well of him.
Yes.
And I want to affirm what you're saying, that like I think that that relationship, that the sort of inimical quality of that relationship is largely artificial, because like you say, a lot of these humanistic psychologists and existential psychologists too were very much grounded in psychoanalytic thinking, have a very deep appreciation for it, and you know, to me it just seems like a tempest in a teapot a lot of the time.
Right. Yeah.
But that's me and
because
you know,
that's because they're all responding to the new media environment and how it threatens the solidity of the literate ego, and they come up with different figures because we are an individualist culture in the West. So that very individual culture has people study around different camps, different individuals, different charismatic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
That's what inevitably leads to any new percept divided into factions. That happens in the West around individuals, whereas non-literate or pre-literate societies fragment into tribal groups, as opposed to an authoritative, informed leader. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but say a little more, because I don't know if I'm sort of getting the whole point of it.
Okay, so you have the Samuel Huntington's War of Civilizations. So you have the suicide bomber versus the soldier, the modern American soldier. And one is going around, the soldier, he represents an individualist culture, and he's up against an enemy that has no individualist identity and blows itself up all over the place. But it's representing a tribal iconic image of Islam. So you could begin to just look at just that modern warfare, how the literate versus the pre-literate or sub-literate or post-literate, the dynamic is right in the sensibility. You have a new general goes to Iran, and who goes to Iran? No, goes to Iraq, and who counters that? A bunch of anonymous suicide bombers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the dynamic there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're all facets of the world we inhabit, you know, and natural tension.
Well, okay, when you use the term world, that's where we bring in, and this is what Baudrillard would agree with, I think, as I understand him, the word world does not do duty to all the various forms of phenomena that happen in different media environments.
Yeah, but
we live in many worlds, which then become my many bodies. But to say the world, that image of a world is not enough.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely true for Baudrillard, but so too is it true of phenomena for Baudrillard. You know, it's not just
yes.
that there's no the world anymore. There's no phenomena as such anymore.
That's right. That's why, I mean, he studied Merleau-Ponty.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, they all have to. You know, he's a Parisian intellectual. They've read their Merleau-Ponty.
Right. And they move through the world of percept that Merleau-Ponty's talking about. And McLuhan just looks at the 20th century and says, everybody moved toward notions of percept versus concept, diminishing concept, because the electric environment was nothing but raw percept and no way to contain with literacy. So he looks at all the phenomena, the different revolutions in all the fields, as just an effect of television or of the multimedia environment. And
yep.
he said, you turn it off, a Merleau-Ponty wouldn't be relevant. If you went
yeah,
back to
well,
the 18th century, conceptual stuff would be relevant because it'd be a limited book culture.
Right, and here's where maybe I disagree with him a little bit, because it sounds like to him it's more of a unilateral kind of thing that's happening rather than a dialectical kind of thing that's happening. In other words...
You mean with Baudrillard?
Yeah, or I think you're pinning it on McLuhan.
Okay, yeah, use McLuhan.
In other words, everything is... Everything becomes TV, in essence. You know?
Right, but you have to remember...
TV dictates everything, whereas I see it in a...
No, but TV against...
I see that dynamic as being true and being operative. I think that's undeniable. But I
right,
see the
but
other dynamic
but see,
as being true also, which is that, well, you know, whatever we are as subjective beings, however you want to define that, also flows into and alters the technological landscape that we inhabit.
And that's what McLuhan's point was, is that he emphasized the media in his writings because his books were satirical. He wasn't trying to create a theory of communication. He was
yeah.
satirizing the fact that the individualist culture didn't understand the tribal and post-tribal dynamic, and that the post-tribal didn't understand the literate. He didn't take sides. He watched the interplay.
Yeah.
So
there
it is. Madison Avenue interpreted him as a technological determinist. He wasn't like that. They made the mistake of just reading McLuhan. If you went and met the guy and saw how he conducted his oral seminars, which was a different medium, you'd have a different view of McLuhan and what he was about. And what
yeah.
you're saying about where McLuhan's limited, he agrees with you.
Okay.
But his books do not purposely present it that way.
Okay, it's just that when you said it, it sounded like more like a technological determinism kind of thing.
Right, well, no, it is a major factor, but then he always said that each culture responds according to its media biases that it already had. You know,
yeah.
the actual phrase, the medium is the message, the word medium refers to the previous cultural framework that a new technology comes into. People don't know that. They think new media are what he's saying when he says the medium is message. No, he says past cultural accumulation is the medium that distorts the view of the pure new that's come in when a new raw experience or medium happens.
Yeah. Well, I would buy that, and I would probably add that, well, in addition to all of that, the previous sort of media or the things that were there on the scene historically,
yeah.
there's the sort of the weird variable of our subjective truth, as Kierkegaard would put it.
Yeah.
You know, intermixed with all of that. I agree with everything you're saying, or what McLuhan is saying, but I would say in addition to that is the sort of uncanny, strange, abyss that is our subjectivity.
Okay, now that subjectivity, one may consider trivial, is allowed to be expressed more and more with the Android memes' abilities to give each one the power to edit and create their own websites and media mix.
Oh, yeah.
So subjectivity is probably a concept that the 10-year-olds, the 15-year-olds will go for, and you could build a conceptual fad on that because it is reflecting their personal experience, where the subjectivity is king over the old analog one-way media.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's no longer king. Now it's just another vassal, and there are many vassals out there.
Yeah, then that's when you get into my multi-body talk, and you get into quadrophenia, which is our own dualism, our own tactile interplay, interacting with the Android memes dualism tactile
yes.
interplay.
And that I think that's exactly what's going on.
Well, there you go. You understand my quadrophenia, which, as a humanistic psychologist, I recommend that my four-body, five-body model solves the requirements in any psychological field.
Well, it might.
I actually think I would.
Comment on it.
Beg your pardon?
It very well might, but I don't know enough of the specifics of your theory to say one.
I know.
Or the
I didn't
other.
Know that you'd be open to it, but you are open to it because we come up to a point of agreement about what's happening. We know that our definitions of what's happening is inadequate. Well, I came up with
the problem
five-body
is the
model.
The whole idea of what a definition is inadequate. It's becoming
yes.
more and more inadequate. The very process of defining is where the inadequacy lies. It's not that our specific definitions are inadequate. The problem goes deeper than that. It's inherent in the very process of coming up with definitions in the first place.
Yeah, now I've said for many years that I solve my therapy, the five-body model therapy, or whatever you want to call it, model, is the answer to this to problems in sociology and psychology and in your field, humanistic. But I present it as a surface fadic, temporary fad, good enough for 6 months that everybody would gather around. But then they'd have to drop it because of what the five-body model implies. So if my therapeutic model would only be useful till everybody got it, then we'd see what the new effect is.
Yeah.
So it would not be a school for too long.
Well, it sounds like humanistic psychology in that regard. That was the point I was
That's
trying to
right.
get at about 20 minutes ago when I was saying that, well, part of humanistic psychology is the undoing of humanistic psychology. Why? Because
right.
it really believes in the process of transcendence as being primary, and that would apply to the project as well.
Okay, that was the second part of a three-part series of interviews that we have with Eric Dodson. The interview with him and Bob went so long, I decided to put it in three separate shows. What follows is just more talking between me and Bob. So let me just end this awkward segue. Put us both out of our miseries. Why don't I? Thank you.
Okay. I always remember when Carolyn first went on television in Toronto on, I think it was like November 22nd, 1986, there was a popular talk show format in the evening on the educational channel, the PBS of Canada. It was called TV Ontario. So they had an hour and a half program called Speaking Out. And she went on there about yeast infections with the creator of that meme, William Crook. He'd done a book on the yeast connection. And so Carol was one of the few first people talking about it. So she went on there. And because it snowed that evening, everybody in Toronto and all across Ontario was trapped inside. And so they all watched TV, and some of them were inclined to watch this well-known Speaking Out show. Now, they got to watch Carolyn. That probably fascinated them because she looks really good on TV. And it was an interesting new topic. But a few months later, Carolyn got word from the program director that they broke all records. They had 86,000 calls in that 90 minutes, which is incredible, you know, in a small country. 86,000 calls, and it could only take, you know, 10 of them or something for the hour and a half. So it was a big success and extreme, and it was a confluence of factors. You know, if it wasn't snowing, nobody would be watching the TV, so to speak. And anyways, but that's Carolyn's luck. She's timing serendipitously. And so it put her on the map for TV reality back then. The thing is, it was the first time she was on TV, and I was watching it live at home. And when she knew the camera was first looking at her, I saw her look to the right, left. She didn't know where to look. Like, all of a sudden, she's looking into the camera, but where is the person you're supposed to be speaking to? And I saw her go through, lose her virginity and go through the discard effect and that momentary confusion about what do I look at? I can't see anything, so I've got to feel it. It's becoming aware of the tactile interval. So I saw her go through that shock, very slight in her eyes. And then after the show, when she came home, she's, boy, that was neat. That was fun. And she wasn't talking. She didn't know about the high response at that point. No, it didn't get reported months later. But she said it was fantastic just feeling the audience and being discarnate. And you could feel the people through electricity. Electricity is an extension of ESP. So she had sensual pleasure of being discarnate. And that's what everybody really requires. They need, they should, media literacy, put the kids in some context where they're broadcasting and an audience is listening. Now, that's pretty hard to do today because it gets all fragmented by the digital. And now people broadcast, we call it narrowcast, to whoever's going to email back that they heard the podcast or who are their friends on MySpace. You know, it's fragmented. I don't know if they could ever have that analog media, one-way media experience ever again. But during that phase, it was a big unconscious desire to experience something that was unique. It was a new form of sex.
Now, actually, Bob, what they do in schools now, and my mom used to produce a show at her elementary school, they play a news wrap-up for the whole school over the closed-circuit TV. Where
yeah.
It's kind of like a kid's news channel.
Right.
So I think that could be good.
No, it doesn't. Here's the point. It can't do it anymore. It's too fragmented. But back then, when analog media was the ground, you had to be broadcast into the general population and feel thousands coming at you. You know what I mean? That's the point. You got to have that accumulated feeling. Did you do it in closed circuit where there's 10 people listening and it's your friends? That doesn't work. You got to have a strange energy that's coming at you. You're going into people's consciousness. You don't know who they are or what they are, and they don't know who you are, and you're inside each other. It's a kind of a possession. It's that experience. And when I went on the first time, I was on the radio October 1st, 1984, and you can hear it on my timeline. It's a hilarious show. And I could feel it halfway through because I was, you know, understood McLuhan and that, but I'd never had that experience. You know, being in the intelligence agency, we didn't make ourselves public, but I knew I had to go public at a certain point. So when I experienced it, I felt it. I could recognize, holy geez, look at that. That's a neat feeling. And I enjoyed going back on the media. It can be an addiction. And that is why the major people, Larry King, Barbara Frum in Canada, she used to be the main Tom Brokaw of Canada. All these people, they're addicted. They may not know it. They cannot live without it after a while. They feel incomplete, and it's true. They've added a new organ, and McLuhan used to call it being actively discarnate. Most people are passively discarnate. When you're watching something on television, you've gone to that room that the television is coming from, especially if it's live TV, you're passively. But actively discarnate is in the position where you feel it. And it's addictive, and that's a bidden. You could look at this mad desire to be on the media over the last 25, 30 years. It's just to get, hey, let me feel that. That's all it is.
That's a new show, Bob. Hey, let me feel that with Bob
Hobbs.
This is good. This is good. See, people, every time I talk to Bob is something different. I wasn't expecting this. But, Bob, this explains a lot in my life. I used to be addicted, you could say, to calling radio shows, call-in radio shows. I've been on a bunch.
Okay, that's a good point. That is the people's access to this discarnate, actively experience. You call in, you get on the line, you might get a minute and a half, but you can feel that audience listening to as you talk to the host. That's the popular of that is the McLuhan used to say money was the poor man's credit card. Well, the talk show, the live talk show, was the poor man's attempt to get discarnate in the analog media phase.
Bob, I have to tell you this story. This really fits in. I was, as I've told you, I used to call into these shows all the time. I called into our local alternative station in Atlanta, and I was talking.
Is that REC? Is that REC?
It's not REC, actually. It's actually more of an African-American based content.
Okay.
So it was.
How old were you when you were doing this?
Oh, man. I was about 25, 26.
And you were a regular. Everybody knew you.
No, actually, no. See, this is the interesting part. It was after Katrina. So I called up this Hurricane Katrina, right?
Yeah.
And there was a lot of racial tension in Atlanta. I could feel the racial tension vibe. I was called a cracker. First racial slur I ever had as a white person. But anyway, I called into this African-American radio station to try to, you know, give my message of peace. And the guy, he really liked what I was saying, Bob. He really liked it. He was feeling my vibe. And he said, "You have the air. You have the floor." He said, "I'm going down the hallway to get somebody to let him hear what you're saying. But you have the floor." Bob, I begged the man not to leave the mic. I said, "Please do not leave. I cannot do this. I just can't." He's like, "No, man, you got this. Just speak your piece. Speak your word." I begged him. It was so awkward, but I could not let him leave. I just couldn't
because
do it. It was too scary.
Too scary to feel the full brunt of this kind of attention on you. That's right. That there's a fear of that also, just like there's a fear of a new experience. You're right. You were afraid of having the discarnate experience, even though you already were, because everybody was listening to emanating at you anyways already. But you thought you required an anthropomorphic projection to hold your hand.
Ah, yes. Very good. And that's what you're doing, Bob, holding my hand as I tiptoe out.
Right. So what happened? Did he leave?
No, he never left. And
he didn't understand why you were being silly, you know, almost, right?
I don't think so. The whole call kind of deconstructed after that. Things kind of fell apart because
And your message of peace didn't go out. And your message of peace was irrelevant compared to the violence caused by this discarnate effect. See, that's the secret truth that McLuhan discovered, the power of this discarnate thing and how it upset all the issues and made content puny. The real issue, the reason there's violence is people want to get on there and feel the active state. They don't know it. They don't know that's their hidden desire. And they also think it's being famous, but it's not to be famous. You know, to be an actress, and you know, an Angelina Jolie, you're only in a movie every year or something, right? And you're not even actively discarnate. That's an old-fashioned, you can even say that's why kids run to Hollywood. They're going, they want to get into old-fashioned medium. Like, Angelina Jolie doesn't get her discarnate experience satisfied unless she's a guest on Larry King or something and maybe hosts the show. See, it's hosting the show that's part of the situation, too. You lead the discarnate populace. You lead that ESP. And, you know, a lot of people just say, "No, I would never do that." They're frightened of it. But they don't know if you're frightened, you're fascinated.
Right.
So isn't it amazing that the billions of dollars made by the TV industry off commercials that are selling to the audience, their messages, is nothing compared to the people who are frozen and staring at this rattlesnake that they want to be in the discarnate position. It's just that. Nothing to do with any of the content ups and downs. That's a very interesting to always remember as you think through these issues.
And that ties back into my initial question regarding the shooter. And if you want to apply this to him, he wanted to be discarnate, which he is. His image will live forever. That crazy-eyed image will supplant Marilyn Manson, as I said earlier, meaning Charlie Manson.
Right. Now, let me point this out. It's failed because he thinks maybe to become the content. No, he wanted to be at the microphone like Larry King and not necessarily tell people what to do, but just be there to lead the discarnate ESP feeling as the host of a show. He shot at rearview mirror things. He shot at figures of authority. He maybe thinks that he's therefore he becomes an image. That's not what he wanted. You want to be actively discarnate at in the Larry King position, feeling the vibes. That's the sensory experience that you get in the discarnate state. That's the sex. And he didn't know. He lashed out trying to get it, and he's not going to get it.
That's good, Bob. That's good. What's interesting, Bob, this totally syncs up with what I wanted to do for this show, and was actually just revel in the feeling of doing the podcast. I had this image in my head that I would just have silence and just feel the vibes of doing it. So it syncs up. So, Bob, you know it. As always, you're ahead of the game. This is good.
Yeah. That's true. Any other comments, reviews? I read some of them you sent to me. They were nice. But, you know, it's not the issue, right? I mean, if they keep listening, but what I'm saying this past half hour should blow them away even more.
Right, right, right. Blows me away. Blows me away even more. So.
Yeah, and you've heard a lot of it. I just keep blown. I'm the four winds unleashed anthropomorphically.
This is good, Bob. This is good. Yeah, well, you've kind of taken the wind out of my sails. You know, you've kind of said it all, really, at this point.
Yeah, no, it's good. That's all we need to say.
I guess. So, all right.
Oh, yeah, I want you to think about, you know, and perceive. You are perceiving what I'm saying. That's good. That's what I'm about. I'm trying to spread the experience or awareness of it. What I didn't get to say to Eric was, they're talking about the Freudian unconscious, the Jungian unconscious, the Lacanian unconscious, the humanist psychology unconscious. No, the unconscious is our technical environment that we're living in. That's the real unconscious.
Right. Hey, Bob, one of the things I want to do, like a next show perhaps, or I don't know, whatever, a show on education, like, because that's one of the big things you see now. Like, what's the problem with education? But there's no.
I just addressed it. I'm always, this very last half hour addresses every issue, every discipline. What are we going to do in a society where the people up till, you know, it's changed with the Android me, the digital phase. But during the analog phase, people don't understand what happened the first 75 years of the 20th century. And what I just described, the desire to be, to experience that new sensual sex called the discarnate experience, is the ground and cause of violence in the whole 20th century.
Yeah, I buy that. I buy that.
And that applies to education. Good. That's a very important educational point for the educational institution. But they won't get it. It's too much. I mean, they might hear it, they think about it, but nobody can deal with it. And so McLuhan said, our populations aren't going to be able to deal with it. Just turn the TV environment off. It's too powerful. We're not ready for it. Take a 6-month break and let's assess what McLuhan saw. Of course, how is he going to do it? Nobody's going to listen to one person.
Yeah, exactly.
So you see, this is apocalyptic, no, it's like Armageddon violence that the Bible imagery is so puny dealing with. The Bible does not lay out the huge Armageddon that's happened on many levels of not just destroying chemical bodies. The violence is so incredible. It is, you could even say it is Luciferian and biblical, but the biblical images don't deal with it. What deals with it is Finnegan's Wake. Look at the page of Finnegan's Wake. It shows you the violence that radio brought in, and that was the beginning back in the 20s.
Right. You know, you're right, Bob. Nobody in education will listen, but my whole thing is let's put it out there to an educator, and then our karma is off the hook. Do you know what I'm saying? We put it
That's
out
right.
there.
We did our part. We did our part.
That's what I'm saying, Bob. And that's one of the points of this show. I'm saying, Bob, we're doing our part over here. You have the podcast. You're listening. Damn it. If you didn't listen, don't come to us and say, hey, where was the answers? Damn it. We put it out there. Whatever. It was free to download on iTunes.
Yeah. Do you know that cliche thing where the kids say, like maybe the German kids in the 50s when they found out about the Nazi concentration camps, they asked their parents, why didn't you do something to stop it? Do you know what I mean? You know, that guilt thing. It comes up. Where were you, Daddy, when this was happening? Why didn't you stop it? This is from the young kid's naivety, thinking that someone could stop it. But and the parents are guilty about that. They even say that in politics. If we don't do something, our kids will make us feel guilty because we didn't do anything. It's a rallying call for many causes. Well, we're the only ones. Well, I can say that 99% of humanity who thought they were doing this and that didn't do nothing. The only person who did and could stand up to his kids is me. And anybody does a show with me.
Exactly. We're trying. But...
At least one human being did it, or a couple of them.
Exactly.
Told the issue.
Bob, I'm like holding up my hands right here. Audience, you can't see it, but I'm holding up my hands like I'm not guilty. I'm not. That's not me. That's all you. We tried. You may have laughed.
Yeah.
You may. What are they talking about over there? Oh, we said it.
Yeah, I dared to go on the air with Bob. Okay, I did it. I took the chance, and I'm still laughing. I'm still here, says the co-host of Bob's show.
That's right, and that's what it's all about these days, is just surviving. I'm still here. Are you still here? Well, this is what helps me be still here. So why don't you come on board, listen to the show? You know what I'm saying? Join the conversation.
I actually say that at the end of the Up the Orphic Andy essay in 95 when I wrote it. I said, join Bob and Connie at Dobbstown. You get the D-cell for immortality, and you will be assured of physical stability if you join us. And that means come on the radio with me or come on some media. I dare you.
And I double dog dare you. Ha ha. Ha ha. All right. That concludes the fourth Bob show. I hope you enjoyed it. And I'm thinking if I should do a little banter about the Super Bowl that is getting ready to be played. I don't think so. I think we've talked about the Super Bowl enough, but I will throw out there, I have a proposal for Barack Obama. If any of his aides are listening, I just want to throw out there, I think he should make this the Monday after the Super Bowl an actual public holiday, mandatory Monday off from work, banking holiday, the whole nine yards. That probably would make him one of the most respected and loved presidents of all time. So just throwing it out there. All right, thanks, you guys. I'll have the fifth Bob show up soon, and probably in the next 2 weeks or so. And that will include the last bit of the interview with Eric Dodson and more of me and Bob talking about deep, awesome, great subjects. All right, see you guys.